WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Marine botanist and deep-sea diver Sylvia Earle has explored the ocean since 1953, when she made her first dive breathing through the newly invented aqualung. 10 years ago, next month, she made the deepest dive untethered from a surface ship to walk along the ocean floor 1,250 feet down, a record she still holds. Earle has logged more than 6,000 hours underwater, including 2 weeks in 1970 in the Tektite II, a multi-level underwater dwelling where she lived with three other scientists. She swam out regularly with the fish, eels, and sharks she came to know as neighbors. Since then, Earle has been in a lot of places other humans have never been, exploring the seas and submersibles that scientists can now pilot down to 3,000 feet. Recently, Sylvia Earle has studied the effects of the oil which poured from the Exxon Valdez in Alaska. She sees the spill as a catastrophic event with an inevitable future, irreparable changes to plant and animal life extending along the food chain.
The impact that most people are aware of relates to the obvious things, that is, those heavily oiled beaches and the tens of thousands of birds, the many sea otters, and the conspicuous goo that for some weeks was obvious to anybody who happened to be in the area, flew over, or walked along some of the beaches. But the long-term effects, the really significant effects, are probably, more importantly, those things that you do not see. Just as the after effects of a storm or a war, immediately there is an obvious reaction, but the subtle changes, those that are there for all time, are what really matter. You have changed the food chain in a significant way, in a catastrophic way, at this point, and that has long-term repercussions. Not just the food chains, but let's say the society of those otters. It is something that will not easily recover. The closely knit social structure that has been dramatically affected. The population of birds that has also been very markedly changed. Yes, there will be birds, but yes, it's a different situation.
In kind of a perverse way, it's almost through disasters such as this that we become more aware of the importance of the oceans. Despite your work over the past several decades trying to get people more interested in the importance of the oceans, it's oil spills like that in Alaska, it's the washing up on the Jersey shores of medical refuse that begin to make people aware that the ocean is actually a fragile system.
Well, in fact, the ocean, the planet as a whole, fortunately, is a fairly resilient system. If it weren't so, we would have been in much greater trouble long before this. It is fragile in the sense that everything that you do does affect something, and a chain of events, a sequence of events, is set in motion that has repercussions that really change the system forever. Even little things make a big difference. But it's resilient because despite the changes that we have made, there is a vast area there that does absorb these shocks that we deliver, and that there are natural shocks as well, hurricanes and the like, that create effects that have long-term repercussions. But in some measure, because we live in a world that is richly populated with diverse species that can be available then to accommodate changes as they come up. What is a catastrophe for some things turn out to be just a feast for others. Even the oil is a feast for certain kinds of microorganisms that for a while will prosper and will undergo a great era of bounty from their standpoint. It's a tragic time for some. It's a time of abundance for others. It's because we have a diverse system that such a capability is possible. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we are influencing the loss of species, the loss of resiliency in the system, we are endangering the health of the ocean and thus endanger our own survival.
The ocean is used for commercial use extensively. And in fact, you have a research company, an engineering company that makes submersible subs that can be used by oil rigs and by the military. How do you see the balance between commercial use and pure research in your work? How do you work this balance in your life?
Deep Ocean Engineering, the company that I started with Graham Hawkes almost a decade ago, was really started out of a sense of frustration. In order to really effectively work in the ocean, just as going skyward, we must make a partner of technology. The engineers have to solve the problems about how to get there, first of all, and how do we effectively get scientists into the sea. It doesn't happen simply by standing on the shore and wishing. We have to overcome the problems of going deep in the sea, of either through robotic methods or through directly taking ourselves into the ocean, developing the tools that make it possible for us to see what's going on, gain access. And the frustration is that even now, when we can do things beyond our own atmosphere in terms of our technological reach, we are still drastically limited in terms of our access deep into the sea. Only once in the history of all of humankind, in 1960, did two men make a descent to the deepest part of the ocean. And it is, after all, only 7 miles down. 7 miles in any other direction is no distance at all.
That was in the Trieste, a bathyscaphe that I remember reading about in the National Geographic. Went down into the Mariana Trench, as I recall.
That's right.
7 miles. You hold the record for the deepest dive down to 1,250 feet of somebody who was untethered from a mothership. And that was, 10 years ago next month?
Well, I used the JIM suit, so-called JIM, named after the first person willing to put this system on. Normally, it's deployed using a tether. I had the fun of using it without a tether, but attached to a submarine for transport to the bottom.
And a JIM suit is kind of like a big spaceship with reinforced helmet and limbs and kind of looking swollen and knock-kneed, as I recall.
A bit like a walking refrigerator.
You say it was fun down there, but there's also an element of danger that goes along with your work, being down there at 1,250 feet. I mean, that's a layer where you could be just instantly crushed by the water pressure, isn't it?
It's far more dangerous getting in an automobile and coming to the studio today and facing the traffic. Actually, going underwater, like flying, tends to be safe because we know to anticipate the problems and pay attention. I think we become complacent in terms of much of our activity in vehicles on land. But the JIM dive was exceptional for its time. That was in 1979, and was a wonderful experience because it showed me the advantages of atmospheric diving, that is, diving with the same kind of pressure at 1,250 feet as we experience here at the surface, at one atmosphere, literally. You're protected, in this case, with metal limbs, arms and legs, just as you are protected when you go into an aircraft. And since then, working with my husband, Graham Hawkes, other systems have been developed, including one called Deep Rover. And Graham Hawkes and I share a record with a couple of other intrepid characters who have gone to 3,000 feet solo diving, but in a system that doesn't look like an astronaut or a diving suit. It looks and is a little submersible, a clear sphere with artificial arms, that is, robotic arms, that paves the way. It really points the way toward the kind of systems that we're looking to take us ultimately back to where the Trieste was in 1960, small vehicles with new materials. And two such systems that, again, are a step downward, if you will, not all the way to 11,000 meters, 7 miles, but at least to take a step in that direction, a system called Deep Flight, two little subs that are being built right now that literally will fly underwater down to 4,000 feet in this case.
And you can go down to the bottom of the sea now wearing in your stocking feet. Just and your street clothes then, without
That's right.
the wetsuit and the goggles. In the summer of 1970, you lived underwater for 2 weeks in the Tektite 2, which I remember seeing as kind of an upside-down thermos. It was kind of an aquatic townhouse, I guess. Were you and a team of three other women, scientists, lived and studied amongst the the fish and the eels for 2 weeks, and you got to know the creatures around you as neighbors. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Well, the wonderful thing about going into the sea or almost any wild place is that as long as you behave yourself and essentially mind your manners, remembering that you are a guest and that this is the home of the organisms that you are encountering, you find that creatures generally do not run off in or swim off in fright, but generally are curious about you. It's quite a different reception than I suspect foreigners who might land from an alien atmosphere would get from us. I've seen so many people in a city run in terror of grasshoppers or other strange creatures strange to many city dwellers, or the first reaction is if they see something they don't understand, to squash it if they can. It's very different from the standpoint of fish and even little crabs. They're more often than not curious, or certainly they are tolerant of our curiosity and will allow the likes of a scuba diver to come quite close. I think some of them are put off by the bubbles that are created through the breathing apparatus, and so some of the systems that we were then using experimentally, rebreather systems that create no bubbles, gave us access, made it possible for us to approach certain fish and other creatures much more closely and creating far less disturbance than standard scuba apparatus allows.
The creatures you've also spent a lot of time with off the coasts of the islands of Hawaii are humpback whales. Were they also treating you in that same gentleness that a curious crab would? Did you have to watch out for these 40-ton creatures that would come sort of cruising past you?
Well, swimming with the whales transformed my appreciation for life generally, I think, not just in the sea. It certainly brought home to me the awareness that your attitude makes such a difference in terms of whether you're accepted or not. Whalers in the 1800s sometimes got retaliation from these great creatures when they went out and speared them. We got no retaliation. In fact, more often than not, the whales simply ignored us. They went about their own whale business. When we were noticed, it was the kind of curiosity that I've seen in small children or even in curious adults when they see something that they haven't really encountered before. They'd come by and take a look and do a big circle and come back and take another look. My first encounter was the meaningful encounter underwater, that is, when there were three of us in the water for more than 2 hours with seven whales who simply wouldn't leave us alone. They came back repeatedly and swam at very close range. On occasions, I could have reached out and touched them, but out of respect, not out of fear, but out of respect for them, I simply didn't. I let them glide by, and those huge eyes the size of a grapefruit or a small dinner plate turned and looked at me. I felt like a mouse being inspected by a big human being.
Would they sing to you?
They were not singing or communicating vocally with us, although I've swum with dolphins that certainly chattered a lot in my presence. They were quiet while they were in our presence, mostly, but when the humpback whales sing, they seem to be very intent on what they're doing. This is a kind of behavior that seems to be related to courtship. And we did observe whales singing. They assume a special posture with their big flippers in a slightly downward position. And most of them that we did see were either making just short vocalizations, but not undergoing these intense periods of sound, of song that would go for maybe 18 or 20 minutes in a sequence and then be repeated over and over again, sometimes one whale singing for hours in a solo stance in a position that in some cases was repeatedly visited, apparently by the same whale.
One of the creatures that people often imagine when they think of diving into the sea are sharks. How have they treated you? Have they treated you with benign curiosity or eyed you more as an appetizer?
Sharks are much, much kinder to human beings than human beings are to sharks. There really ought to be a study made about the number of sharks consumed by human beings. It would make the reverse position look just trivial in comparison. I mean, the chances of getting eaten by a shark are, it is said frequently, as good as being struck by lightning, or probably a greater chance of being struck by lightning. And that does happen once in a while, but so seldom that we really don't worry about it very much. And again, one's behavior counts for a lot. If you go out spearing fish and tie them to your belt, it's essentially like ringing the dinner bell, and that you should be attracted, cause sharks to be attracted to you should not be a surprise. Mm-hmm. And those occasions when I've had the fun of actually seeing lots of sharks underwater, usually it has been when an effort has been made to deliberately attract them using bait. Occasionally I have seen large numbers of sharks without any deliberate effort on my part or any of those in whose company I happen to be, but rather we just happened to be in a place where the sharks were naturally in large numbers. Mm-hmm. And once, and only once, in thousands of encounters with sharks have I felt just a wee bit of concern. And it was while we were working with whales. I was with Al Giddings, a well-known underwater photographer, currently famous for documenting the underwater sequences, most of them. He's in charge of the underwater photography for The Abyss. In this case, he was working with us to document the behavior of the whales. And we were in the Alinui Haha Channel in Hawaii, famous for the high waves, also famous for an occasional appearance of white-tipped sharks. We happened to be in an area where the ocean was very rough and very clear. We jumped in the water when we saw whales, but once in the water, the whales disappeared. But almost instantly, we were the subject of attention of first one and then a second white-tipped shark. And being a good photographer, Al Giddings, of course, documented this on film instead of coming to stand by me to try to cope with the sharks. So he has a record of me trying to figure out what to do as first one and then the other white tip sort of comes over for a close pass and a little too close for comfort. But a swift kick with my flippers discouraged both of them, and they soon were about their business. Again, your behavior makes a big difference. I suppose if I'd acted like a wimp and started to cower or swim away, I might have wound up with a little nip out of something more than just my flipper.
Just your flipper. Al Giddings has worked on the Abyss and the Deep, and your husband, Graham Hawks, piloted one of the submersibles that was used in a James Bond film, For Your Eyes Only. How do you react to the Hollywoodization of the oceanography business in this way? Would you like to have a role in a movie? Did you like the Star Trek work with the humpback whales trying to save them?
Well, I love the Star Trek IV film about the whales. Telling a story to convey a philosophy, I think, is a wonderful means of communication. I do not like the approach where you mix up the truth and a story in the sense that you should be careful to tell the truth when you're giving a documentary, just as David Attenborough does. There's no fooling around in his portrayal of the truth, but there's nothing wrong, in my view, of telling a story that conveys a philosophy. Abyss conveys a philosophy. The Star Trek IV conveys a philosophy. They make no pretense at telling the truth about the nature of life or any such thing, and I can live with that all right. As for me being a star in such things, no, I'm quite happy to try to be an ambassador on behalf of the fish and the whales from a scientific platform. I think that there is a place and a real need, however, to get everyone who cares, everyone who has a talent about anything, or not necessarily a talent, but just an interest in trying to convey the importance of the oceans. We need poets, we need writers, we need scientists, we need engineers, we need musicians, we need politicians, we need the whole spectrum of humanity to become aware of the importance of the ocean. The oceans right now, on just a national, let alone a global balance sheet, I think gets very largely short shrift. It gets taken for granted. And yet we are utterly dependent on the good health of the ocean. I think that one thing that we're beginning to see is an increased awareness of the significance of the oceans. As we find scientists looking at the problems associated with global change, the greenhouse effect, the ozone layer, how do we cope with these problems? How do we solve the problems of living in compatibly within our environmental means in the future? Eventually, the arrows point back into the ocean. It's the great stabilizing factor that largely goes unnoticed, largely gets taken for granted. But we are having an impact. Prince William Sound is an example of a situation where human action has created not just a problem that has had a widespread impact environmentally, but it's having a widespread impact on the behavior of human beings, on the philosophy, and perhaps on the policy that will enable us to live in due course, when we correct some of our errors, in a way that will ensure our long-term survival.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and explaining what's been going on in our oceans to us and taking the time to tell us about your work. Sylvia Earle, marine biologist, thank you very much.
Thank you.